This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Oh, wow, do I have a wonderful story behind this book today. I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Lisa Black, and the name of her book is The Deepest Kill. Lisa, hi, how are you?
Great, how are you doing?
Oh, I am so happy to have you back. I have now developed a ritual when I read one of your books.
I just
love this so much. This is the third in the Locard Institute thriller series. And I remember when I read the first one, I said to myself, oh, this has to last a long time because I love it. Having myself worked in a laboratory when I was young, for 3 years, I worked in like the sub-basement of a hospital laboratory. So I am working, you know, in different departments and going around and visiting the morgue. I just love your writing. I love the storyline of this wonderful series. It is just like, it's gripping. You are so fantastic.
Well, thank you.
Well, there are not many members of the American Academy of Forensics who are also sisters in crime and Mystery Writer of America, and someday Mystery Writer of America Grandmaster, I think.
Well, from your lips to the Edgar Committee's ears.
That's it. Well, you're going to get a lot more books in this series. You know, I remember thinking when with Sue Grafton, I was waiting, you know, to interview her for Z, and I had told her I wished, you know, she had a different alphabet to work with. But you're going to have, there's going to be so many books because there's so many stories. It's partly ripped out of the headline, but also just you've developed two wonderful characters. Tell us about them and how you came out with the idea too.
Well, I always like working with a team, of course, because in a team, then one person's expertise can, you know, fill in where the other person's expertise fills in as well. So they complement each other, because of course, in reality, you don't have one person that knows every single possible thing about, you know, crime scenes and what can happen to the human body and everything. So in this, we have Ellie. Ellie Carr is a former crime scene investigator. She was on the evidence response team with the FBI. So she's very well versed in, you know, crime scene and fingerprints and photography and working the scene. And then you have Dr. Rachel Davies, who used to be a medical examiner, and she's now the assistant director, one of the two assistant directors of the Locard Institute. And the Locard Institute, she's put 10 years of her life into this institute, and she absolutely loves it. But she, partly because she needed regular hours, or better hours, because she is raising her late sister's toddler son. But the Locard Institute is like one-third does training for law enforcement and forensic personnel and scientific personnel, does one-third research. All the professors and scientists there have their own research projects trying to forward the abilities of forensic science. And then one-third private cases, which is the fun part, you know, as far as the series goes, is where they're going to get to go to, you know, different places, different locations, even globally, and have all sorts of variety in what they're investigating. And I set it up like that purposely. And so they can complement each other in terms of the investigation that, you know, Rachel understands psychology. She's kind of a little better with people than Ellie is. And she is, you know, a former pathologist, so she knows all the pathology questions, all the autopsy, can handle the autopsies and figure out what's going on with the victim. And then Ellie can work the crime scene. She knows, of course, you know, the fingerprints and investigating all the trace evidence and following the physical trail. So, well, that's kind of a summary.
That's, you know, and it's so wonderful. What I love, of course, people, my listeners already know, I mean, you are a real forensic person, you, an active working person, still involved in forensics. So the reality and the authenticity you bring to the stories is just marvelous.
Yeah, I try very hard to keep everything realistic. And if I do fudge any details, I will admit it at the end in the acknowledgement section. But I try not to write a textbook as well. So I will, you know, like, kind of summarize the boring parts, so I don't want to bore my reader, but I want them to understand how this science actually works in the real world, that it's not like television. You don't just hit a button, or you don't have a bat computer that you can drop a substance in and it will tell you everything you want to know. There are limitations, of course, to any scientific testing. And I have been in forensics for, you know, close to 30 years now. I started at the coroner's office in Cleveland, Ohio. I was in the trace evidence department. I'm not a doctor. And then for 24 years, I've been with the police department in Cape Coral, Florida, doing mostly fingerprints and photography and crime scene work. It's kind of like one huge bedroom community. So we handle everything from, you know, a smashed mailbox to, you know, double homicide. So.
Well, you bring it all into your books. And, you know, with this book, it was so funny. I love the first chapter. I loved the way you get into the story. You tell so much. You make, I can tell you, it's always so hard when you have to kill somebody off or when somebody has to die in order for you to have a story, because even in just a little bit, you want to care about the person, you know, there's going to be a body. It's sort of like NCIS, you know, there's going to be a body. But so the first chapter is great. I loved it. I thought the deception detection, I call that the deception detection chapter. But I must tell people, the last chapter in this book is so exciting. The first paragraph in that last chapter, I read it once, and I read it twice, and then I have to read it again because your mind has to sort of go back in time to what the character had done before. And then I continued reading, and I realized, I don't know if it just came naturally or you worked so hard on getting just the right arc, the excitement in that chapter. You know, a lot of times a last chapter in a book, you know, you get the bad guy or you do this and that, and it sort of eases out. But this has such punch, the entire chapter. I mean, it really, they can study that in one of these MFA classes. Study that last chapter, because Lisa Black is a genius at creating tension.
Good, thank you. Yeah, I had another version in which there was, you know, kind of a wrap-up chapter at the end, and my agent said, you know, I'm not sure about this part of it, and I said, I really want to end it like this, and she said, well, yeah, then do that then. So, like, I always try to make sure, like, all the loose ends are tied up. I hate it when, you know, loose ends are left hanging, so I just kind of had to make sure that anything the reader might be wondering about would pretty much be answered. And so then I could leave it, you know, with that last kind of, you know, punchy ending.
It is a punchy ending. It's great. It's really great. I noticed in your acknowledgments, this is funny, because it was a subject that recently came up with some of my listeners who are, you know, just writing their books now. And you mentioned that you have a critique group that you you attend, mm-hmm. right? Well, so many of the people who are just starting off, and particularly ones who, you know, just are writing their first one, they don't want to show it to anybody. I mean, it's not just, they don't want a critique group. And when I saw that, I mean, they don't want to even join one of those little groups in the library where, you sit around and talk about your books because they're afraid. And I was thinking, does anybody actually critique you anymore? I mean, does anybody ever say anything? Like, Lisa, that's the...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Critique groups are invaluable because it's sometimes there's something you think, oh, nobody's going to buy this, and they, it's just fine with them. And then other times you write things that you think are just fine, and they're like, yeah, that's not really working for me. So I always say critique groups, if one person says one thing, you should take it with a grain of salt. But if, two or more mention the same thing, then you don't have to do what they suggest, but something about that is taking them out of the story, and you need to pay attention to it. So, yeah, critique groups are absolutely invaluable. I would recommend them to anybody. And we're always very nice to each other. We're always, we're all aware that we're all writers and, we're all fragile. And no matter what stage of the game we're at, we're all fragile. So we're always like, I'm not being quite able to picture this, or, this kind of just strikes me as odd, or, maybe it's just me, but I would word this like this, this. So we're very nice to each other, but it's very helpful.
It is, and I Mary Higgins Clark was, she was still going to a critique group in her 80s, and she said it was wonderful. I mean, a lot of it is just, talking and getting together with friends, but they actually do, say to each other, well, that doesn't quite work, and they were friendly, and they were, helpful, and I really found it so interesting that so many young people, the young writers who are just coming up, and they don't want anyone to read it. I got one of them said, well, if I send my manuscript to you, will you read it? But I don't want to hear anything bad.
Don't okay. Tell me it's terrible.
Okay. I mean, I wouldn't do it, but it's just so funny. So I think I just want to encourage people out there. If Lisa Black when she writes so beautifully, can go to a critique group, you can do that too.
Yeah, so, it's there. No matter what stage of the game you're in, they're always helpful.
So let's talk about the plot of this story, because that, the writing, the book, I just found it so exciting. So as I said, it's torn out of the headlines. It's like a how you can take a story that, people hear these kind of things all the time, and then you have turned it into something really magical in the way of a thriller. But tell us the basis for the Martin Post, and he's the third richest man in America. So what do you want to tell us about the plot without giving too much away?
Well, I always describe the plot as it's the Lacey Peterson story if Lacey Peterson was Bill Gates' daughter. Now, granted, I know nothing about Bill Gates. I've seen a few documentaries on the Lacey Peterson case, but that's it. So everything else about it is made up. But I cannot tell you why or where it came from, but basically I started with he's a software genius. And the other dimension to the whole story is that he's working on a new version of basically a satellite defense system, which if you're old like me, you remember back in the 80s with Ronald Reagan, the Strategic Defense Initiative, and everyone called it Star Wars, and it was going to protect us from the Russians because the Cold War was still going on. The Berlin Wall hadn't fallen yet. And it never actually came about because apparently arranging a bunch of satellites to defend us from Russian missiles is not as easy as it sounded. But it was a big thing for a while. And defense contracting is a whole world that can be really fascinating. So I have that going on, and then he is working on it. His son-in-law, who's this slick, basically rich, spoiled frat boy picture, you know, picture that kind of character, and his daughter, who's married to his daughter, and his daughter is about 8 months pregnant, and she likes, and they all work on this project. So she goes out, she likes to go out on her boat in the Gulf of Mexico and work, and that's how she can focus on coding and everything else. She takes her laptop, and she disappears. Her boat's found, but she's not there, and then her body washes up about a week later. So Dad thinks it's his
You build a wonderful story around all of that, all the technology, which must have been also fun to do some research on, and but it comes down to humanity, human beings. So that's why I love I love that deception detection. You know, at the beginning, it makes us think, and it just beautifully written. Right from the get-go, it's a book that people will enjoy. So one of the things when I have you on, so I can ask you at least one technical question. I always like to learn something, and since you're a fingerprint person, I mean that has been so much of your life. What is this recent report about fingerprints aren't actually? I mean, you could have more people having the same fingerprint. Is that true?
No.
Well, they came out last week with a headline saying it's not distinctive.
Yeah, well, actually they are. You know, you can say that, but in 150 years of searching fingerprints over and over all days, all night, now we have computers that's 24/7, 365. We've never found two people with the same fingerprint. Now, does that prove that there can't be two people with the same fingerprint? No, it does not, because you can't prove a negative. Like, you can't prove that unicorns don't exist. But, you know, would you bet a court case on the fact that they do? So it comes down to that. And can examiners make mistakes? Yes, they can and have. So, you know, if you have a client who's being convicted by a single fingerprint at the crime scene, you know, by all means, question it. Ask the expert. Get your own expert. Get a second opinion. Have the expert explain in court and show, you know, big blown up pictures of the fingerprint. You know, by all means, question it. But are you likely to win? Probably not.
Do you like appearing in court to testify?
No, I hate it. It's absolutely the worst thing in the world. It's the most nerve-wracking, exhausting. It's you're completely under everyone else's control. You have to show up when they tell you to show up, whether it fits in your schedule or not. You have to stay there as long as they stay there, as they tell you to stay there. You have to wait sometimes all day and then come back the next day. You have to sit on that stand and answer questions for as long as they choose to ask them. It's nerve-wracking. It is not fun at all.
So, you are the one who will actually go out to a crime scene. So, right? I mean, you go to crime scenes. It's not just you're sitting. Somebody brings you a fingerprint, so you get to go to crime scenes.
Yeah.
Wow. I think it's so fascinating, and that you became a writer with all of this, you know, this background. As I said, not many people who are in the American Academy of Forensics are also writers.
I don't believe there's too many that write fiction in a way. I mean, a lot write nonfiction, but, you know, but I don't know of too many who are fiction writers.
Well, you have really proven to be just so, it's just so much fun. As I said, I have now a sort of a tradition that I don't let anybody else bother me reading one of your books, because I know I'm going to be so, I just tell people, don't bother me. I mean, I can, you know, I read a lot of books. So I'm reading and I can do things and I can, you know, multitask. I might answer calls. With your books, I don't. I don't want to. I just find
good.
Myself
yeah.
a comfy spot. Because, it's partly, of course, because I just love anything to do with laboratories. So that just takes me back to sort of, I know people think it's a weird thing that, you know, we've worked in morgues and worked in, you know, stuff like that. In those days when I was young, nobody really talked. We didn't have any, a lot of people women who were going into forensics, but you've certainly made a big hit in the forensics world, I would think.
Not really. Nobody,
no?
People sometimes ask, you know, it's like, oh, what do your coworkers think? And, you know, do people recognize you at crime scene? Like, no.
No.
Nope. I mean, occasionally a coworker asks me, you know, like, oh, how are the books going? But they never actually tell me that they've read any. So, no, I'm not as much of a celebrity in the forensics world as you would think.
Well, I think you're a fantastic writer. So you're working on, you've already finished book four?
Yes. It went to the editor a couple weeks ago, but they've been moving offices, so I'm not sure if she's actually read it yet.
So do you like the editing process?
No. It's kind of like going to court, you know? You're entirely at the mercy of other people. And it's like people who don't want to be in a critique group, you know? You never know what they're going to say, and it might be like, you know, oh, you're going to have to rewrite the whole thing, or, you know. It might be like, oh, you have a few typos here. It's like, cool, I can fix that. Okay.
Well, I want to, again, as I said, I think that, of course, you've gotten so many wonderful, wonderful reviews, because I can't, when I think back to it, I remember when I read Red Flag, and I just, at the first time I read, started reading you, I said, oh, this is exceptional. And I knew that you would be back many times. So you're going to be back on Joy on Paper. And we'll be talking about book four whenever it comes out. And again, Lisa Black, you have a website you want people to go to?
Yes, www.lisa-black.com.
Okay, people, you can find more information about Lisa there, and of course, her books are available online. And do you ever listen to the audiobook version of your books?
I did a few of them a while ago, but no, not really, because I'm usually on to the next one. You know, by the time it comes out, I'm on to the next one, thinking about the one after that.
Well, this book is called
I do love audiobooks. I listen to them constantly because, you know, you can, they get me through so many tedious tasks like working out and cleaning house, etc.
That's true. But this one is just, for me, you are one of those sit down, I'm not going to be bothered kind of books. I get a kick out of it. So this one is called The Deepest Kill. It's a Locard Institute thriller, number 3, and it's available online. It's a really wonderful book to read. Takes you sort of away from everything else for a little while. And again, Lisa, thank you so much for joining me on Joy on Paper today.
Well, thank you for the invitation. This has been a lot
okay.
of fun.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Wow. Wow. What a book. What a book. Okay. We're going to have a promo for Jim Lamb and his wonderful book, Herding Butterflies. And then I'm going to come back and I have a really special guest.
Looking for inspiration? Looking for something that will intrigue you? Then this book is for you. Jim Lamb's poems start out as caterpillars, creepy, crawly, and raw. Then a miracle happens as they transform into colorful, bright, and conspicuous works of art. You can find Jim's new book of poetry, Hurting Butterflies, at Amazon.com. It's the perfect gift for the book lover in your life, even if it's you. Hurting Butterflies, the perfect holiday gift, available on Amazon. Get Hurting Butterflies.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
And I am back with my next guest, Jennifer Lang. I'm so happy to welcome her to the program to talk about her book, Places We Left Behind, a memoir in miniature. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Patsy. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I should say shalom. So you are in America right now?
I am in the San Francisco Bay Area at the end of another book tour and seeing family.
Well, I'm so happy to welcome you. I wanted, you know, when I first heard about this micro memoir idea, I was intrigued, and you have just pulled it off so beautifully. There are so many things I like about this book, and I was thinking, you know, when you do things in this book, you include things like charts and other things in the book that it's quite unusual. So I thought, when they decided to publish you, that you had this concept, which, you know, is different, and it looks different as we're reading it. I think it's brilliant.
Thank you. I call it, without, for lack of a better word, I call it experimental prose. I don't know if that's what it is. I really created it just kind of after seeing small publishers say in their submission guidelines, open to experimental prose. It started there. I was like, wow, I wonder what that means. And I fell down a rabbit hole, but it's almost like it wasn't an already existing rabbit hole. It was my own. I did this on my own. And well, the publisher saw it with some of it, some of the experimentation, and liked it. And then once I got the feedback, you know, it was an offer of publication with, we love what you're doing. I was like, I'm going to do more before I have to submit the final manuscript. So that's what that is.
Well, I have to explain to people, it's unusual in a book to have all sort of sentences stuck out from the regular, you know, lineup of paragraphs and charts. And I thought it was so clever, and really it enhanced the book so much, because I get a lot of memoirs, I get so many of them, and, you know, they're always interesting to read, but with this experimental method, I thought you really added some depth to it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. One of
Explain your story, because it's fascinating. You've had quite a journey through life.
Okay. So, raised in California, California-born and raised parents, rooted. I grew up really, really rooted. I knew who I was. I was a Northern California Reform Jew. And that said, in my childhood, which was, so we had affiliation with a synagogue, Reform, and youth group, and camp, and these things really shaped me. But we also had what most people in the 70s in our Reform world did not have, especially in California, which was close ties to Israel. So I had a great aunt and a great uncle who came with my grandmother and another three siblings from Romania to San Francisco in the 1930s and with their parents. And in 1947, two of them left, arriving in pre-state Israel in 1948. So my first trip to Israel was 5. So we made these trips during my childhood, really traveling at a time when people just didn't do travel like that. But let me back up. Places We Left Behind, A Memoir in Miniature, is a love story with a lot of conflict, inner and personal, marital and geopolitical, about home. It starts in 1989 when I meet my French husband in the hills of Jerusalem, and ends in 2011 when we make our final return, our third time back to Israel to try and live there with 3 kids. We left in 1994 with 1 baby. We returned in 2007 for 1 year with 3 kids in school. We left again. We returned in 2011 with 3 kids, 1 who went into the army and 2 into school. So it was a lot of movement, a tremendous amount of movement for 2 people who couldn't agree on home. So the fact that I grew up really rooted, in contrast to that, is like I kind of look back sometimes. I'm 58, and I still look back and I think, what happened? But I think what happened was growing up other in a small city called Piedmont in Northern California, other as Jews in a very, very non-Jewish place, not religious, not God-fearing, but culturally, with Eastern European grandparents from Russia and Romania in San Francisco. And I think my sibling and I always felt it. I mean, it was hard to avoid. My mom started coming into my classroom in kindergarten every Hanukkah. She came in with a menorah, candles, the story of Hanukkah, a griddle, and the dough for the potato pancakes, and she would light the candles, and she would say the blessing, and she was not religious, my mom, and she would make potato pancakes and pass them out with applesauce and sour cream and share the story of Hanukkah to share our differences. But nobody else's mom was coming in to share the story of Christmas. But my mom, at probably around 3rd or 4th grade, said, enough, stop. So we grew up other. We grew up different. And I think that's really the root of it.
And that contrasts with your husband's background. Explain a little bit where he came from.
Yeah. So my husband is from Alsace, France, from Strasbourg. We're both from Ashkenazi backgrounds, so Eastern European Jewry. He grew up. If you ask him how he grew up as a Jew, he will answer, I just grew up Jewish, whereas I say I grew up Reform, because in America we have boxes and labels. In France, they really don't. He grew up as a Jew who grew up keeping kosher, separating milk and meat, meals and dishes. The kitchen was always kosher. When they ate out in non-kosher restaurants, they never ate non-kosher meat. They never ate shellfish. They lit the candles and said the prayers for the wine and the challah bread on every Friday night and Saturday for Shabbat. He went to synagogue every Friday night with his dad and his brother and his mom. His mom always sat separately because women and men were divided. He grew up traditional. And so when you bring that amount of tradition into America, which is where we lived for most of our 16 years raising kids, it translates into modern orthodoxy. So a completely different beast, if you will, from the way I was raised. It's where your religion, your Judaism, is your lifestyle. So our kids went to modern Orthodox schools. We were in modern Orthodox synagogues. And every 7 days, our family life was very intense and focused around going to synagogue and being with friends who did what we did. Very community-oriented. That's the part I loved. But it was not a given to take that on because I didn't have the belief. I didn't believe in God. I couldn't just jump in and say, oh, yeah, I'll do it your way, which he asked me when we were 23, with pleasure. I said, I'll do it your way, but I kind of kicked and screamed the whole way.
So it is a different lifestyle when you honor Shabbat. Your life changes in so many ways when you do that. Isn't that right?
Oh yeah, yeah. We would eat in non-kosher restaurants, but I had to always read menus first to make sure there were enough vegetarian options. We never took the car from Friday sundown until Saturday sundown. We never spent money. We never turned on and off lights, used electricity, cooked. We did all the cooking Friday afternoon for the next 25 hours. It's intense. If you aren't raised with it or if you don't believe in it, it is intense. And there's a beauty to it. I just probably didn't see the beauty when I was in it.
Well, but you met in Israel. So the two of you met in Israel. Which in itself is a fascinating experience. Of course, you went to Israel when you were a child, but then when you got a little older and you started going around the country, there were some things that were really surprising about Israeli behavior.
Yeah, I mean, I got older, so I became more aware. So. Culturally, there's a lot of differences. I mean, we could say that, you know, you can go country to country and observe the cultures. By the time I went back at 23, it was after living in Paris. I my mom put me in a French class when I was 6, an experiment in our community, and I stayed almost my entire childhood. I studied French. So I did my junior year abroad in Paris. I wasn't 100% fluent. I dreamed of fluency. So after college, I, by stroke of luck, found a job in the Jewish community in Paris. I had a dream come true situation, 21 years old, independent financially, worked on the Champs-Élysées in a Jewish non-political organization, but and legal. They got me work papers, but my boss and I did not care for each other. That's a nice way of saying it. And I knew my time there was limited, and I couldn't stay in the country if I wasn't legal. So I really mastered French. I was in the job for a year and a half, and I quit mid-year. I quit in February 1989. And at that point, I decided I was done living abroad. I was ready to go back to America, and I was on my way to graduate school, waiting for rejection letters, acceptance letters, which would come that spring. And I decided to spend those intervening months, like March and through August, in Israel, where my sibling had immigrated and some really, really close friends were doing different things there. And so the last thing my mom said to me before I got on that plane was, whatever you do, don't fall in love and stay. Because I think she had two friends whose daughters had done that. And I promised her, but you should never promise. I promised my mom exactly what she wanted to hear. And 5 weeks after I got there, I met Philippe through a mutual French friend. And, you know, broke my promise.
Very quickly broke my promise. But when you went back, of course, one of the things, I remember the first time, you know, when for an American, you go to Israel and of course, you have expectations and ideas. But I will never forget the first time I had to catch a bus in Israel. And, you know, I am always early for everything. So I had to catch a bus, you know, at 6 a.m. and I was there at 5:30 and I'm standing in the spot where the bus is going to, you know, open their doors, pull up and open their doors. And I'm standing there and, you know, I don't move. I've got my bag, in those days, a big suitcase. We didn't have rolling bags even then. And I'm there, and then the bus pulls up, and out of nowhere, all of these people just rush right past me, get on the bus. Nobody cares about that. I'm a silly American girl with this too big suitcase, and I am the last one to get on that bus. Nobody helped me. Nobody cared because they weren't going to get at those seats. And, yeah. You know, eventually I got on and I'm standing. I was trying to figure out, how did they do that? And I thought they were so rude. But then later on I learned that's just sort of the Israeli way.
I was going to say, so the Israeli way, I think, is summed up in one word, which many people know in America, which is chutzpah and, you know, nerve. But I think there's good chutzpah and there's bad chutzpah. And
yeah.
I've come to admire the good chutzpah. And I think it's definitely shaped me as an adult, for sure. Between Israeli chutzpah and the way my mom raised me, with the mottos my mom raised me with, I would say we were out to dinner with my closest childhood friend, our parents, you know, best friends in college. She says to me last night, "You're so fearless." And I thought, yeah, I think I learned that from home. But I think I've also gotten it from living in Israel.
Yeah, you do get that from living in Israel. So yeah. Let's go back a little bit to this idea of you wrote a memoir, and it was sort of regular length, the typical, you know, like what was it, 60,000 words, 70,000 words.
Oh,
how
no,
did you just...
It's really atypical. It's 14,000 words.
Well, no, the new one, but the original one, when you originally started writing, did you you didn't intend to write such as it's what,
correct,
120 pages, I think it's like something like that, which
is
not typical.
Right. So the correct. So there. So 7 years ago, I had a 95,000 word manuscript.
Ooh.
That I had finished, and I hated. I couldn't even turn the page. I was so bored. I mean, Nothing about it. Not the word choice, the sentence structure, the narrative arc, the story. Nothing. It just didn't work. But I hired what's called a developmental editor to help me shape it, and she gave me amazing feedback, really helpful. But the main thing she said to me was, "Don't try to work on it now. Put it away for a while. Let everything sink in." And I put it away, for probably 4 months, and then. So that's where my story really starts. I put it away for 4 months, and at some point during those 4 months, I took a class online, a flash class. A lot of people know the expression flash fiction, but I'm nonfiction. So for me, I was writing everything true from my life in Israel, and it was, I don't know, 24 like complete strangers, virtual. This is before the days of COVID, so we didn't talk about synchronous and asynchronous time, but it was asynchronous. And the feedback I got from a lot of people who read my work was, wow, you're like, you know, it's fascinating. I hope you're writing a memoir in flash about your life in Israel. So I would say the seed for this short writing was planted there. But it still took years. And what ended up happening is that 95,000 word manuscript has been cut and really reshaped into two. And it turns out that unintentionally, Places We Left Behind is part one. And on October 15th of 2024, part two is coming out. Part two starts in 2011, where this story ends. And it's called Landed, A Yogi's Memoir in Pieces and Poses. Yoga plays a big part of both books. Yoga is a big part of my journey. And it was so unintentional. The second manuscript is 3 times longer. So the first one ended up as 14,000 words, and the second one is about 45,000 words.
But still short, even for
yeah,
a memoir.
Yeah. The press that I am working with, Vine Leaves Press, I knew they published short books because I had read No Place on Any Map and Postcards from Here. Postcards from Here, I think, is Penny Gissinger. No Place on Any Map is, this is terrible to not have the name come to me. And I had read these books, and so Vine Leaves Press at the time called them Collection of Vignettes. So that I knew to approach them because I knew they published these short books. It helped, you know, you got to do the research to know.
And you're right. Not every publisher would go for it. They really don't.
Correct.
So many don't want anything out of the ordinary. I mean, they don't want you to, if it's a printed book, they don't want drop caps. I mean, they're really set in their ways in many, many respects. So that
right.
You have one who is willing to work with this experimental format, and then to see how really well it works. As I was going through it, I said, this is sort of startling. Sometimes I would say, wow, she's got this in here. She's moved this sentence to this side, and she's doing, I enjoyed that so much.
Thank
I think
you.
The surprise of it helped always to create that you wanted to get to, you know, beyond and keep reading.
Thank you. Something that's like a pet peeve for me as a reader. So I, as a memoir writer, I love reading a good novel. Love, especially historical fiction. But one of my greatest pet peeves, like the older I get, the more I read, the more I write, I've really come, like the quicker I'll put a book away if, when a writer repeats information, like dumbing down the reader, thinking a reader can't remember from an earlier chapter some key piece of information, and just keeps repeating it chapter by chapter. I can't stand that. So if you remember, you might not remember, but there's a chapter called, and I call them now chapterettes. I had been in conversation at Zibby's Bookshop in Santa Monica last week, and I was in conversation with a writer, Blair Glazer, and she called them chapterettes, and I'm like, oh God, I love that. So that's my new word for what I've done, chapterettes.
I love it, there's too.
One, right? Creative. There's one called Coordinates, and I give real coordinates of two different places on the map. And they're real, and it doesn't matter that the reader knows where they are. It's irrelevant because the reader understands towards the end of the book that they are probably one in America and one in Israel. That the reader will understand it. And so I couldn't bear once again to you know, on page whatever it was, to say the same thing over and over. I can't stand it. And so I figured out like how to show it differently. So that's also a lot of why I did what I did.
Well, there's a freshness in it. And what's cute, as I'm listening to you, you do sound so Northern Californian. I know you're not a teenager anymore, but you have that vibe of that. There's a certain sound to a Northern California girl.
I've been told I sound really young. I think that's what you're trying to say, which is really nice because I'm 60 in a year and a half, so that's really, really nice to hear. But another word people have used I've used this word. I call it experimental prose, playful. Playful prose, and so another way to say what I've done is I've created this, whatever, unconventional text that's very playful, which mirrors my marriage. So while my marriage, we had some really hard years, like over two decades of hard, because we couldn't agree on where to live and how Jewish to be. So those are the essence of the conflict. Our marriage has always been playful, a lot of flirtation, a lot of game playing. From the moment we met, we've been playing games. It started with backgammon. We carry a deck of cards everywhere we go so we can play gin rummy, gin. And we have a group of friends we play code names with. So that playfulness, I also really like it because, first of all, I think otherwise the conflict, the strife in the marriage just, like, is too heavy. So I feel like it lightens it a little bit. And it mirrors the marriage.
Well, it works. It really, really works. And I am so looking forward to having you back in October. And we will be talking about book two of your memoir of your life, which is fascinating. Like you, I come from a background where I never expected that I would become a world traveler. Actually, until I was 11, when I decided to move to England, and I followed up on that. And 10 years later, I was living in England, and I had bought a house. So it's so exciting to discover somebody who's done a lot of things. I love it. All your stories are fascinating. And I think every reader for this book will want to read the next one.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me for the conversation.
Well, it's been great. Now, you have a website you want people to go to?
I would love it. So it's IsraelWritersStudio.com. Writers Studio is just one S. And you see my book information. You see I teach creative writing in Israel. I sometimes teach online. That information's there. My shorter pieces, which have all been published, are there. Thank you so much. I'm also on Facebook, Jennifer Friedman Lang. Jen Lang Rice. Yeah.
Well, again, I think what you've done here is, it's in many ways, it's really groundbreaking. And I just compliment you so much on it. It's really wonderful. And your story is fascinating. And I just got a kick out of this book. So again, thank you for joining me today. You will be back. And I know you're going back to Israel.
Yeah.
We have this sort of stay away from that right now. I'm not up to even talking about it myself.
No, me neither.
I will be thinking of you, your family, and all the families in Israel as we continue to, to have to suffer through this. But thank you so much, Jennifer Lang. You're fascinating. The book is great. It's called Places We Left Behind, a memoir in miniature. And you can find it online, and you can go also to Jennifer's other Facebook and website. But thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today, Jennifer. It was really a joy to talk to you.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Okay. Wow. People, I think you will find, if you read this, there's so much in this book. It's funny how when somebody really hits the nail on the head, I would say, that it's a kind of book where you're reading it and you say, wow, what a clever idea. And I love it. I just love it. So, again, it's called Places We Left Behind. Now, again, thank you, everybody, for the notes I've been getting for the 9th anniversary of Joy on Paper, which is coming up in March. I have a lot of things happening, and I will be talking about them, and my guests, and all sorts of things. But Bill Larson will be on in March, and we're going to be talking again about intellectual property. Thank you for your questions. I know so many of you are worried about AI and how to work with it or not work with it. I will say that I've been a little shocked about some of the things that have been happening. So I hope that you will send me your questions for Bill Larson about intellectual property. Say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed. Bye-bye.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
Listen.
It's time for the Thursday edition of Canada Calling, the news from home for vacationing Canadians. Pryor Smith speaking from Toronto. Thanks for joining us. Here in southern and eastern Ontario, we're into yet another unusually mild stretch of weather, with a daytime high in Toronto, for example, today, up near 50 degrees Fahrenheit, the kind of conditions we would normally expect at the end of March, not the end of the third week of February. It'll be chilly in this region on Saturday,